Welcome everyone to What the Force, and welcome to a new episode all about Mandalorian history. I'm Marie-Claire Gould, your host, and with me is Allie Andrews, the host of the Knights of Ren podcast. Welcome, Allie.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
We've been like online mutuals / friends for a really long time.
Yeah.
I think I'm trying to remember when it started. It must have started when you said, I'm starting a podcast.
And I was It was actually. Yes, yes.
And I said, you're starting a podcast. I want to help you with that. Because that's like, I try, especially like new people that are like starting out, if they want advice or anything like that, I try to give them advice because it is intimidating and scary and hard.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave you some advice right off the bat. And
you said I was too loud. And I was like, sorry.
No. And it wasn't like an insult. I felt so bad after that.
It was all good. We had a weird start, but it was fine.
Well, it was just because your levels were a little off, right? And yes. And there's tools and techniques. And,
yes.
And just like, it's just knowing the thing. So like, if you're ever interested in starting a podcast and you're like, hey, how do I get going? Like, there's like a, like now a weird checklist in my mind. I'm like, you need this thing and you need this thing and now do this. And then once you have that, you know, record a couple of episodes, learn how to edit, learn all the pieces, get some people to beta listen to it, because you're not going to be used to hearing the sound. Like, it took me, well, maybe 4 months to become a halfway decent editor of a weekly podcast. And yeah, so that's how it is. How has your journey been, like, becoming a podcaster?
It has been a crazy road. For anyone who knows me personally, they know how insane my podcast experience ended up being, because I started it with someone, then a bunch of drama happened in my life with that person, and that person left, and I had to find it. But then I was alone for like 4 months, and then I had to find a new person. And I was also super self-conscious, so I wouldn't have, like, you would offer to do beta listens. I never did it. You gave me advice. I still was like, oh no, I'm scared. But like, I don't know. It's been weird, but I think I finally, like, I'm podcasting with Maria, and it feels great, and I'm excited to keep going, because honestly, those, like, however long it was, 4 months that I was podcasting alone was just super duper awkward, and it would always be, like, nerve-wracking to, like, ask for guests, because I didn't always want to record alone, so.
That awkwardness of recording alone is what keeps me asking for guests, because exactly. I've done... two in a mini episode alone, maybe two mini episodes alone. So 4 episodes alone, and I hated every single one of them.
Oh yes.
I struggle with it. I love discussions.
Yeah.
So yeah. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. But we have a history, and we actually met at Celebration,
yeah,
which was so much fun to actually see you in person.
Oh my god. I'm so awkward though. Like, everyone who met me knows just how awkward it was to meet me.
You know, it's okay to be awkward and like come into yourself and then figure out who you are. It's really okay, Allie. I was like, awkward when I was your age. So awkward.
Meeting you was automatically the best, because you literally gave me like survival food, because I was worried I wouldn't be able to pay for meals. So you literally gave me like a bag of food on top of the candy that you were passing out. And I was just like, ah.
I was handing out bags of Canadian candy, because like people can't get it in the States, right? So like Smarties and like coffee crisps and stuff like that. Like, people that I was like, oh, I love you. Here, take some candy. And Allie was like, I'm so hungry. And I was like, oh my god, mom mode. Here, I brought these snacks because I worry about myself and I don't want to have to, like, you know, buy a whole bunch of stuff at the like Celebration grounds. And so here, take these snacks. And it was like literally like a Ziploc bag of like, I don't know, it was like oranges and like granola bars and like random stuff. My super mom moment.
I mean, I didn't go hungry that week, thanks to you.
Oh, Allie.
I mean, at least next time I will do a lot more prep money-wise, and so hopefully I won't need snacks next time.
Well, you know to hit me up, because I have snacks.
Yeah, exactly.
You're like, MCM hungry. I'll be like, oh, Allie. But we have 2 years. You have two years.
We have 2 years, exactly. That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, put away some money every single week and you'll be good. And then I won't have to worry about you and try and track you down. Be like, Allie, did you not eat? But what I love about you is that you started your podcast, The Knights of Ren, which was a reference to Sabine Wren. Mm-hmm. And I think kind of the Knights of Ren, like it was like, oh, good, like hodgepodge or mix mashup, right?
Yeah.
And your love for Sabine was so like effervescent on Twitter. No, it's so good. It's so good. You're like, you're just a pure joy. And recently, like today when you were recording, or was it yesterday you finished the Rebels Awards?
That was yesterday, all day yesterday.
Yeah. So like there was a couple of people who have been doing like, you know, hey, vote for your favorite X, and then on Twitter they'll just like announce what was top, etc. And you're like, I'm doing this, and you did it for Rebels, which was so good because Rebels has such a place in my heart. And what about like Rebels and Sabine is so appealing to you?
Oh my gosh, Rebels just means like so much to me. I say this every time I podcast Rebel pretty much, but when I was younger, like I was born after the prequels, so I was kind of born in the like the weird period where nothing was really happening at all. So I kind of, that in that way, Rebels was just a big thing for me because it was kind of like my first, like, yeah, I saw the movies when I was younger and I watched Clone Wars, but I was still so young to the point where it just wasn't like clicking in my head as much as Rebels ended up doing, because that was like the first Star Wars thing that was like new for me. It was just always there for me. Like it started in 2014 when I was 13, and then it ended when I was like 17 or 18. And so it was just in that period of my life that was so like, I was in high school, life was crazy, and it was just always there for me. So that really grew my love for it. And I loved the characters, especially because like with Clone Wars and the films, it's kind of like all pre-established, but like Rebels, you were getting to meet these new characters and they all had different backgrounds that were so interesting, and getting to learn about their stories. And out of all of the characters, I just really connected with Sabine. And I've said this before, but it was not just for the fact that like we ended up being the same age at one point, and I always say that was something that connected to me, but it was also because we both did art. So we were both artists. And then her story in general, I just found it so interesting because growing up, connecting to what we were talking about today, growing up, I always found Mandalorian history and the Mandalorians interesting. I always loved the Mandalorians. And so getting this new character that was a Mandalorian, but like in a way she was like the first Mandalorian we got where her like story wasn't just Mandalore. Like she was there as like in this family and supporting this crew and growing the rebellion. And so
and she had had like an Imperial tie for a period of time by going to the academy.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like she had all of these like layers to her, and she also felt like a very private individual, especially in the first season. So there was a lot of mystery to unfurl there.
Yeah. So it's like the season's gone on and getting to learn more and more about her story. And this Trials of the Darksaber, dude, that was like the episode that like, because like I already love Sabine, but that was the episode where we really started to get to see her like open up. We got to hear more about her past and the pain of her experiences. And then through those last two seasons, we just got more Mandalorian content. Like most of the Mandalorian content we got in Rebels was like in those last two seasons. And so it was just so, so, so cool to see her growth, her progression, to hear about her past, because it just, it fits so well into, as we're talking about today, Mandalorian history. Like it connects to Mandalorian history. And so I loved her so much. And I could literally, like I have on my podcast, I talked about her for like 2 hours on my own podcast. So I could say so much more, but that's just the general rundown, I guess.
We'll link to it, to that particular episode, so people can listen to you gush about your love of Sabine, because she is amazing.
Yes.
I also agree with you. Like Sabine was one of the characters that drew me to the show. Also Hera, because by the time the show was on, I was already a mom. Rebels has like a really special weird place in my heart, because every episode that came out, I would watch it 3 times in a row. You know? So like, and I would watch it with like myself because I couldn't wait. I would watch it with my family and then I would watch it again the next day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, I don't do that with Star Wars except for now The Mandalorian. So that's really interesting that there's so much Mandalorian stuff. And truth be told, I never really liked The Mandalorians and I grew up with them. And like my main understanding of them came about from the Knights of the Old Republic RPG video game. So the original one created by BioWare, where you understood that there was a Mandalorian war in the past. And that's probably the extent of the legend stuff we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
Because we're going to try to keep in canon because we don't know what's officially going to come back. But we do know that a Mandalorian war happened at some point in the past. And we don't know when that was. We don't know anything about it. We know that they fought Jedi.
That's literally what I have in the notes. I'm like, war, Jedi. And that's like it. I was like, yeah. Okay.
And we know that there's like these remnants that are around in how they talk about things. And like to the most recent episodes of the Clone Wars, they're artifacts. They have artifacts of that bygone era, like the coffin thing that they hold Maul in has like all this mural type art on it explaining what this coffin thing is for, which is to restrain Force users, which we get from Bo-Katan.
Yep.
So like there's this history and that's as far back as we know. In KOTOR, it's the reason that Revan actually goes to the dark side. He or she, because you could choose. Revan was always a woman for me because I was always playing her. Goes to the dark side basically to prevent the Mandalorians from taking over the galaxy, you know. But we don't know that that's going to happen that way or what. But I hope that we go back that far at some point. So that's kind of our start. That's what we know.
Yeah.
And then there's some cultural things that seem to be left over from that period of time, which feels very, I would say, Italian city-state in political and cultural structure. Because there's house and clans, and that's very like, you know, in Fair Verona, where we lay our scene, these two houses. The, you know, Capulets and the Montagues. It feels like very Italian city-state during the Renaissance in some ways.
Yeah.
Tell me more about the house and clan society.
Well, Mandalorians, there's houses and clans. No. The clan is more tied to family. And we see this especially in Rebels with Clan Ren, as Sabine and her brother and her mom are like all Clan Ren, and that's like their family. And whereas the house is more like the kind of cultural warrior division of, it's like how with Death Watch, they're House Vizsla, and then with Clan Ren is also houses, but like the houses are basically more so like that general society kind of makeup of their own societal structure, whereas clan is really tied to their family. And I think it was really interesting to get to learn, see that more with Rebels again, as I say, because like we always got like, oh, this is like House Vizsla, it's Death Watch. And then with Rebels, we really got like Clan Ren House Vizsla, where we got to really see more specifically how a specific family can be a part of a house. And as we saw with Clan Saxon as well, there came in more conflict between that and like how much you have to be loyal, especially when the Empire is involved, like where your loyalty is just so tied to that. And that's why the Death Watch were so on their plan, because not only were they holding on to their warrior culture, but their group was just so tight-knit because of that societal makeup.
The houses to me feel like, if I can just kind of like draw a parallel to like medieval society, when you would swear fealty to a specific lord, you would become part of their household. And even though you might not be that clan, you're in that like sworn fealty structure.
Yeah.
Clan Ren being part of the Vizsla house means that their loyalties are in that direction. And from an honor perspective, it's a very bad thing to break your fealty to the house that you have sworn to, basically.
And that's why I love how Sabine's such a rebel. She literally says in The Protector of Concord, she's like, my mom was in House Vizsla, but I'm not Death Watch, because like Death Watch is like House Vizsla. So when she's like, I'm Clan Ren, House Vizsla, they're like, Vizsla, she's Death Watch. And she's like, my mom was Death Watch, but I'm not. So like, I love that about her. But like, I definitely agree with what you said. It's like, it's really interesting to like, see how it's not just their own cultural makeup with being a warrior society, but they have their own separate houses, which honestly, going back to what we want to see more of, if we do see more about Mandalorians and stuff in the past and all that kind of stuff, I think it'd be really interesting to learn even more about the houses, because a lot of what the content we've gotten so far has been so focused on House Vizsla that I think it would be interesting to learn more about the other houses.
And to like, just because I love crazy politics, like what we get in Shakespeare in, you know, that period of time, like, because, you know, Two Gentlemen of Verona, Romeo and Juliet, all of that is during the Italian city-state structure, which is this, you know, house. Who's in charge of the city and who gets the favor from the prince of the city? And that's the kind of political structure that is behind the scenes in those Shakespearean plays. But that was actually like a very, very important period of time for Italy, where, you know, there was a lot of patronage of the arts, a lot of advancement in science and thinking and philosophy. And but there's also a lot of fighting, like literally like fighting internally. This is the time of Machiavelli. And I think that they could pull a lot of those threads into the house structure of the Mandalorian with the armor and, you know, the fighting and the warrior code and all of that stuff. And it would just create like such a dope show.
Yeah.
Show, like just so good. It's already written in my head.
Yes.
Just based on like real stuff that happened, like there'd be so much inspiration. And there's like, you know, court politics too, on top of that, because like sometimes women weren't always warriors, but sometimes they were in the Renaissance, especially. Mm-hmm. So you could have like courtesans. That would be cool. okay. So we have our houses and our clans that are the direct family and like their legacy and their name. What is the creed of the Mandalorian? Actually, maybe we should talk about who Mandalore was first.
Yeah. All right.
Before we get too deep into the chronological stuff.
All right. So Mandalore was, so this is prior to, or at least the way we get it introduced to us in Rebels, kind of, this was like prior to all the Darksaber stuff. So this was, Mandalore was like the original leader of the Mandalorians. And he was backed by the Protectors, as we see in Rebels. That's the house is the Protectors.
Mm-hmm. And he was just a guy.
Yeah, who, like that's what I
became a leader.
What else would I say?
Yeah, like no. He was just a leader. He's kind of like how, you know, Dooku, Count of Sereno, the original Sereno, was the leader of that planet. And so there's a little bit of that happening in the galaxy, where like the first one to become the major leader of a planet, the planet is like named after them.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little bit of that happening in Star Wars. I think it's easier that way for them.
I think when we talked about the Darksaber later, we might get into it a bit more. But I think this is especially interesting because the Darksaber largely becomes later a like symbol of leadership for the Mandalorian. So I think, although we don't really know much about Mandalore, I think it's particularly interesting that this was before the Darksaber was in the picture. So it's like, here's a leader who doesn't have like this symbol of leadership backing them up. And so like we don't know a ton, but I find that
Mythosaur, right? Because like they tamed the Mythosaur, the former leader tamed the Mythosaur, and that became their like totem or their, you know, their crest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so that whenever you see like the Mandalorian symbol, that's the skull of the Mythosaur.
Yeah.
Which is referred to in The Mandalorian, which I thought was really good because it's literally called a Mythosaur. Like a mythological beast.
Yeah, I know.
it makes me so happy. But we don't know much about Mandalore other than he gathered a bunch of people together, and they're not necessarily like you would think that like Alderaanians are like a certain type of people, maybe Nabooians are a certain type of people. Mandalorians were just brought together because of their shared interests, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
Does that feel right?
Yeah, no. I mean, I think that's always, obviously, there comes to be conflict later or with specifically following their culture or not following their culture. But like, I definitely agree that it's definitely those certain interests that help bind them together in the way.
It kind of reminds me of, what's the show? Andromeda with the Nietzscheans.
Never seen it.
Okay. Well, like there were like a warrior culture that was like genetically modified.
All right.
Yes, warriors.
Yeah.
Anyways, but they were banded together kind of by a belief structure, and that I believe was the creed.
Yeah. I believe it like was first like the creed, and then the code kind of came in later as like a societal like function, however you want to put it. But yeah, definitely. I think they were like, okay, so we have these common interests of like being warriors and all of that. But definitely the creed, I think, was formed to really help solidify this kind of like cultural, societal joining.
Yeah. It's just, you know, it's kind of like, well, this was their rule of law or what they all agreed to, you know, in a we all buy into society. And so this is what we all agree to exist in this society. Mm-hmm. Is the creed like documented anywhere?
I couldn't find it. That's why like we hear about it in The Mandalorian, and like, so that's the only reference point I really could find, but all the other stuff is legends related, I believe. And so I don't know.
Yeah, we're not going to go into that.
Because
it could change. Like that's like one of the reasons why we're not going to be, other than touching on this did exist in legends, because like even stuff to do with like Jedi trials, there's now a whole TV show associated with Jedi trials, and the trials are not anywhere near the same as the legends ones. So I believe that the concept of a creed will still exist because it has been brought up.
Mm-hmm.
But what that involves could still be yet to be determined.
Yeah.
And that's pretty consistent with what we've seen with legends pullbacks, is like they kind of change a little bit. So we will wait and see. But there will be something that was like a rule of law that, you know, to be a Mandalorian, you kind of swore to.
Yeah.
And then the code kind of like solidified that maybe for the warriors themselves, I think, a little bit more.
Yeah, definitely, especially because the one instance where we get to see it the most clearly in canon is with Sabine challenging Fen Rao. So it's definitely, in that right, we see it more as the warrior kind of way of working through things. Yeah,
and it's kind of like, I don't know, like for lack of a better reference point, but the 10 things you have to remember in a duel from Hamilton.
Of course.
You know?
Yeah.
Like it's like that now. Like that, you know, hey, if you want to take over power, you got to do X. You know, if you've made your word, you've got to live by it, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And in that episode, in case people haven't seen it, what happens?
Queen invokes the code and the protector of Concord Dawn because she is what Fenrau did to Hera. Yes. Yeah. She pretty much says, I invoke the code for single combat against, I don't remember the exact words, which is kind of embarrassing. I know like everything in Rebels, but like she basically invokes the code. She's like, I want single combat with a person. They're like, who do you want to challenge? And she's like, Fenrau. So, or when Fenrau shows up, she's like, I thought you'd never ask. I challenge you, Fenrau. You're going to pay for what you did to Hera. See, I know a lot of Rebels lines. I just don't know all of them.
It's okay. It's okay.
Yeah, she basically invokes it in that episode because of how they went to the protectors to try to get like a system of passage or whatever you want to call it, hyperspace route, so they could like get past like Imperial supervision and occupancy or whatever. So they basically they tried to link up with them, and they had ties with the Empire, so obviously they were attacked. And then following the attack, Sabine is like, she kind of like gets into her warrior ways where she's like, oh, you have to pay for what you did, like it's all your fault. And that's why throughout this episode you're gonna see a lot of Kanan kind of challenging her warrior past. Well, she also challenges his like Jedi philosophy, which I thought was really, that's why I added them when I did the best duo award. I'm like, come on, like they challenged each other's beliefs, and they continued to throughout the show, which I thought was chaotic and awesome. But yeah, and then she basically invokes the code for that combat to, in her warrior ways, make him pay. Yeah.
Because something had been broken, basically, and she demanded retribution for that, which is very similar to like the duels we see in Hamilton, not unlike sword fighting duels that you would see in, you know, the Middle Ages, etc. Dueling in general, yeah. It was very much an honor based thing. Something is broken, and so you have to fix it via fighting for your life.
Yeah, and actually, speaking of the whole honor thing, I know this is jumping ahead a bit, but like I will talk about Sabine as much as I want to, but this is jumping ahead a bit. But like an example of that is like we see a lot with the Mandalorian ways, and in her duel with Gar Saxon with the Darksaber, she's like, that might be the Mandalorian way, but it's on my way, like to kill Gar Saxon, which she like disarms him. But she's like, that's maybe the Mandalorian way, but it's not my way. So clearly they have like these, like, she doesn't specifically say it's ties to the code of the Kree, but like they have these like beliefs, and in combat, like it's like what happens, how when Maul is battling Pre Vizsla, like only the strongest shall rule, but like Sabine challenges that in that moment. So it definitely is tied to, I guess, not really honor, but it's tied to that like kind of Mandalorian belief, cultural warrior, whatever you want to call it. But I think
definitely their culture. Yeah.
So it that could be tied to honor in a way. Like Gar Saxon probably believes like you need to fulfill this honor, just like Maul did, of like the warrior way of defeat. If you defeat me, you must kill me, and that's how you will lead. But she challenges that, which is awesome.
yeah. And I like the idea that we've seen kind of how it turns out in some ways, you know, with the Mandalorian, with Rebels, you know, mm-hmm. we've seen these hints that things go horribly off the rails. but it also sort of shows us like how things were, mm-hmm. because of how she says no to certain things, and how you know, Satine, in her actions, you know, by saying, hey, we're no longer like that, mm-hmm. you know, versus Death Watch. Like there's really, it's what I love about what we've seen in The Mandalorians is there's been a lot of show us, don't tell us. And we're like guessing in some ways, yeah. because we haven't seen everything. And that's really exciting to me. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we had Mandalore, and then we had the warring between the Mandalorians and the Jedi. And we got a lot of hints of that, mm-hmm. especially in season one of The Mandalorian.
Yes.
Primarily from the Armorer talking about the rival clan of force wielders, or wizards or space wizards. I don't. What did she call them again?
Pretty much.
She called them like magic wielders or something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, and then in the end, she actually made the child and our Mandalorian Din Djarin a clan of two.
Mm-hmm.
So she made them a family, and that's why using the word clan and pointing that out is really, really important to say. But mm-hmm. this ties, you know, in a big circle back to, well, when were they fighting and why are they still enemies and why would she still refer to them as enemies? And mm-hmm. why would any time the Jedi came to Mandalore, everyone's like, God, no. Because there's this history there.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of it, as tied to their warrior culture, a lot of what we can infer and stuff is tied to the fact that, like, they saw the Jedi as these magical people who had magical powers. And as a warring society, they're like, we got to challenge that. We got to prove that we are, like, the worthy ones that can overcome that. So that's definitely, I think, a big factor in all of that. And, and like you said, it's awesome that we get to, like, see more and more. That's, as we've been saying, with each show, with each new thing that's released, we get to, like, see more hints or learn more, and it all ties in a big circle. So I love that we've been getting to see, like, more background and hints to things.
After this Mandalorian war at some point in the past, so first we had Mandalore, the creator of the Mandalorians and the Creed, and then we had the Mandalorian War, and then we had the Darksaber period of time.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that? I literally know nothing about this other than...
No, it's all good. You're
Sam Witwer always yells, that's mine, on Twitter whenever the Darksaber shows up on a television show, which I enjoy.
No, I'm so excited for when Hasbro releases that Darksaber toy. It's a toy, but I'll be like, look, I have my own Darksaber now. Okay, back to the so the Darksaber period. So basically the Mandalorians were, like, at war with the Jedi. They, like, didn't like that they overcame them. But so the only Mandalorian ever to be accepted or allowed into the Jedi Order was Tar Vizsla, and we specifically get this background from Fenn Rau in not Legacy of Mandalore, Trials of the Darksaber. So we basically get to learn that he was accepted into the Jedi Order, and while he was there, that's when he, like, developed creative, whatever you want to phrase it as, the Darksaber. And he was, like, a Jedi, and, like, everything was great. But then during the fall of the Old Republic, the Mandalorians, they infiltrated the Jedi Temple, and they liberated the Darksaber. And this was, I believe, House Vizsla. And that's how the Darksaber ends up with Pre Vizsla, is because it was liberated by House Vizsla. And that's basically the beginning of how this the Darksaber, like, becomes this big symbol, because
it's very much like Excalibur.
Yeah.
From, like, a feeling perspective, because it, like, represents the leader of the Mandalorian people, and it has that kind of mystical association to it, that, like, he who holds the one true sword, the Darksaber, will rule, you know.
And this isn't specifically said in any property, but I like to kind of think of it as, because they were, like, so at war with the Jedi, that in a way, because they were able to liberate the Darksaber from the Jedi Temple, they're like, oh wow, it's so powerful because we got it from the Jedi Temple. I don't know, that's just my own little weird thing, but, like,
yeah,
it all ties
cannon.
Back to that kind of, like, warrior-esque mindset, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. And then, you know, eons passed, 1,000 generations of Jedi. I don't know how long. We don't know.
We don't.
We don't know how long this period of time between when the Darksaber was to when the Mandalorian Civil War happened, which is when we entered the pacifist era of the Mandalorians. And we don't know how far in the past that was, do we?
We know because Qui-Gon Jinn and Obi-Wan were aiding Duchess Satine, so we know it's definitely like around the prequels, because Obi-Wan was definitely younger here, but like it's so in that
probably
time-ish period
post Master and Apprentice.
Yeah.
Right? Because he's pretty young in Master and Apprentice. I think he's like 17 or 18. Like, he's pretty young in Master and Apprentice. Mm-hmm. And then after that, he's like on the run with Qui-Gon. Why haven't we gotten that book?
Please.
Where, like, had you asked me, I would have left. Like, come on.
I know, right? Exactly.
Like, that's going to be the angstiest story. Why haven't they told that story yet? So she was advocating, like, socially for social change, and mm-hmm. people were trying to kill her for it.
Obi-Wan basically is like, they sent bounty hunters after us. We were, like, always on the run, like, doing our best to survive. So it was, like, definitely, she was trying to promote this pacifist way of living, because she saw, like, you see how much the war, largely because of how much destruction was caused by the war, and we really get to see this in the show about how, like, the planes were destroyed and they had to live in the dome, whatever they're called, the domes, to, like, survive and stuff.
And we see that quite clearly in Clone Wars, in the last season, you know, that with the fight on the roof of the dome too, which was really, really cool. And I didn't realize that was literally how badly destroyed the planet was.
Yeah, it's like that. We especially get it. I just rewatched this episode yesterday. Sabine is talking to Ezra in The Heroes of Mandalore, and she literally, Ezra's like, oh, they've done so much to my planet, but, like, this is, like, wow. And she's like, yeah, once upon a time, these, like, plains were filled with grass, but I never saw it because all of the destruction that happened with these wars just, like, destroyed it. And we also get to see with Concordon, like, we see it destroyed, and Sabine's like, that's what war's done. Like, there's so much we get to see with how much war has affected their world. And
I assumed Concordon was destroyed during the Clone Wars.
Yeah, but I'm just saying in general, an example of how much war has come to, like, just
there. And I think it makes sense how much Satine was, like, massively trying to promote pacifism, and, like, to have this very, very antagonistic, you know, Pre Vizsla of Death Watch going after her, also played by Jon Favreau. He does, like, an excellent job of sounding like an absolute jerk the whole time. And like, I find it really fascinating that he loves the Mandalorians so much. And I want to have the opportunity one day to, like, sit down and ask him, like, what about them is so interesting? Because I don't know that he's ever explained exactly what about them is so interesting to him. Because what did we have growing up other than, you know, the Star Wars holiday special and, you know, like, before the prequels and even with the prequels, we didn't get more Mandalorian.
I wasn't alive, so I never was surprised.
Yeah, we didn't, like, Boba Fett wasn't a Mandalorian. He was just a bounty hunter. We didn't know anything about Mandalorians until the EU, and then the EU made them this warrior culture. So I'm wondering if that's, like, where he got all of his love from, or if it's, like, you know, kind of his own stories playing Star Wars in his head. You know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know. I'm really interested in it. But everything that's being built right now is very, very complex and interesting and feels very like knights in some ways. And there's a lot of that motif happening, especially in The Mandalorian. So it's interesting. So The Mandalorian Civil War happens. Somehow Satine survives. With protection of the Jedi, takes over.
Yes.
Actually becomes, is she the queen?
She's the Duchess.
Right, she's the Duchess. Which is I guess we have a count who's in charge. So
there's the Duchess, and then we get the Prime Minister, who's Almec. And then
it becomes a democratic society.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's take a step back for a quick mo. There is old monarchy / regency history scattered throughout Star Wars. It's really interesting. So like when you read like Bloodline, you find out that there's these old houses, and they like houses were entire planets sometimes. and it's just like kind of under the surface. And I'm wondering if they're trying to like pull that out more, because like we have a count, you know, Count Dooku. We had Leia, who inherited an entire planet and then decided to give it away. Right?
Yeah.
We have princesses and queens, and like there's this regency type aristocratic layer to Star Wars that we've never really dug into. And the fact that she's still a duchess is interesting. Because a duchess is in medieval times, a duchess would be like sister to the queen or sister to the king.
Mm-hmm.
so where's the king?
Maybe it is part of her pacifism that she doesn't feel like she wants to, I don't know, this is all speculation.
No, I know. I just find it very interesting because like also like the Countess Sereno is in charge of the entire planet, and it's a sovereign planet, but he's the count.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe there is, and this is saving for my future speculation conversation in a little bit, but maybe there is an old imperial type kingdom type city state structure, because you weren't actually the king of a city. You were the prince of a city in the city state structure. So maybe that's what it was. And you kind of named yourself the highest thing, but you never said you were the king, unless you were like, of course, the queen of Alderaan, because she's dope. Brea can do whatever the hell she wants. I don't know. It's interesting because I'm like, there is no consistency. So
yeah, no, I find it, you know, so interesting the way you're trying to like work through all that kind of stuff. Like it's like, because we have like a timeline here, but like there's still so much like opportunity to like look at other to like try to like figure out
they could fill in a lot of political history and make it really interesting, in my opinion. Like get some cool political writers, have Aaron Sorkin write. Just kidding.
No, like if I was like, honestly, I'm not doing like an English major, but if somebody any day came up and wanted me to do a Sabine Wren or a Mandalorian novel, I'm on board. So like, yeah, it's definitely you filled exactly what I was trying to say. Like you can fill in so many like gaps, or you can speculate so much about why certain things are the way they are. And I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, we see this during the Clone Wars, the pacifism that they have, the new Mandalorians that they have, you know, so hard to fought to no longer fight, literally fought to no longer fight.
Yeah.
Are being challenged from the Moon of Concordia, where Death Watch lives, which is this like remnant of the old way. And to me, this feels a lot like, I don't know, to tie to, the U.S., I'm sorry, but like the remnants of people that are like left over from the, you know, the Confederacy, like, you know?
Yeah.
but just like that they still want to have certain things their way. And, you know, even though they quote unquote were defeated, they're still around.
Yeah, like at least their belief even in Clone Wars, Duchess, or why am I calling her Duchess? Satine is like tells Obi-Wan, like, oh, they've all died off. Like, they were exiled, but they've all, like, died off. There's probably no one left. Like, she just, like, assumes, she's like, oh, they're all gone, but they're still there.
It's been, it's been, like, 20 years, like, or 15 years. Like, it hasn't been that long, Satine.
But she just, like, oh, yeah, they're all gone. Like, but they are still there.
Pre Vizsla doesn't look that old, like.
Yeah, and they're still, like, holding on to these, like you said, they're holding on to these beliefs and these principles, and that's why they are so needy to take a stand. Like, you see this in Clone Wars, how much they're like, we gotta take a stand, we gotta, like, take back what's ours and, like, go back to our old ways. But of course Satine, she's continuing to promote this pacifism while excusing, not really excusing the problem, but she, like, tries to, I don't know what the right words are, but, like, throughout the Clone Wars, those arcs, she's like, oh, they're just, like, warrior, like, they're just the Death Watch, they should, like she says, they should be all dead, or they should, or they're just a small problem. But, like, obviously throughout the arc, she comes to more and more see how serious of a problem it is, but she just works so hard to try to promote the pacifism, and those beliefs to, in her eyes, like, save the society from more destruction. So, yeah.
It just feels like she was denying the fact that this group still existed
exactly.
in her society.
Yeah.
And, like, from a Robert Bly perspective, she was denying her shadow, and so it literally grew. Like, it's like denying the dark side. Like, I don't have the dark side, but there it is.
Yeah.
It's like hiding underneath, right? Uh-huh. Like Anakin, right? she just, you know, and in the end, you know, Pre Vizsla ended up being very, very overconfident, especially with his, you know, agreements with Maul.
Yes.
You know, and Maul, as much as I love him, is opportunistic AF. Like, he absolutely will just do what he needs to do to survive and to gain as much power as he needs to gain to be successful.
Yeah, like, when they first take Maul in, they're like, oh, he's an enemy of the Jedi, so it'll be fine if he's an enemy of the Jedi. He'll be, like, with us all the way. And then even when they're making deals, he's, like, telling Bo-Katan, he's like, oh, we'll be able to overcome them. We'll, like, defeat him. It's okay. Like,
do we understand why, like, Bo-Katan was working with Pre Vizsla versus Satine? Was it just, a family disagreement?
I think it had to do with she really was still believing of their not believing of the pacifism. I think this is what I inferred as a kid, at least, that it was that she just disagreed with Satine's beliefs. And that's why she largely tries to follow Pre Vizsla. But it's only ultimately
she still believed in the honor and the creed and the code and all of that, right?
It's only ultimately when Maul, it's because when Maul takes over, that's when she, like, freaks out, because it's like, like you said, with the honor, Maul's, like, not Mandalorian. Maul's just this outsider that her and Vizsla have always doubted and always been against and always been like, oh, we shouldn't be working, or at least she's, like, questioning working with him. So that definitely goes back to, like, that honor stance where she has had these disagreements with Satine, but the enemy of my enemy is now my friend. Because ultimately, once that power dynamic shifts, she can work past those ways to at least be okay with Satine, because at least she's has more of that. Like,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And like, Satine is still her sister. And so, like,
yeah.
I don't think she ever wanted Satine to die. maybe. And, you know, it is.
Who knows?
But Maul takes over by killing Pre Vizsla and taking the Darksaber. And, like, that's all the symbolism that the Mandalorians needed to, like, you killed our most powerful leader and you took the thing that we have built an entire culture around.
Exactly.
Cool.
Yeah. Cool.
Plus, he also brought with him the crime syndicates that he had also, you know, built up along the way.
That whole episode is so cool. I just have to say that. That episode where they're building the Shadow Collective crime. Oh, so cool. When they go to, like, the different systems and they're recruiting. I just thought that was a cool episode. And, yeah, as you were saying, like, it's all the symbolism. But to a point, like I said with Bo-Katan, there are those people who still see like how Maul's not Mandalorian. Maul is, even though he, so there's like the difference in point of view, I think, because it's like, yes, he took the Darksaber and he overcame his opponent, but then there's still the fact that he's like not Mandalorian, that he's an outsider. So I definitely think that's why there was that division in that moment. And yeah.
So then it came down to like, do you believe that, you know, the Mandalorian people slash creed is the most important thing, or is it the thing that the person can pretend to be?
Exactly. Yeah.
And fulfill. Yeah. Right? So that's where the complexity comes in. And because, you know, Clone Wars season 7 with the Siege of Mandalore, because the Republic was there to get Maul, they stayed there when Order 66 happened and the Republic became the Empire, thus the Imperials took over.
Well, yeah. So following the end of the Clone Wars, I don't remember what content we learned this in, but following the end of the Clone Wars, Bo-Katan was basically like regent. She was like the leader, basically. But she, oh yeah, it's in Rebels, I believe she says. She basically like refused to follow the Emperor or like bow down to him. So yeah. Then basically,
well, she was definitely in charge at the end of the
Clone Wars. Yeah, yeah. But that's allowed Gar Saxon to kind of step in. Because of the way she like disagrees and doesn't want to follow the Emperor, then Gar Saxon is able to like make this deal and become like the Imperial Viceroy of Mandalore. Yeah.
Yep. Viceroy, another title that is used a bit in Star Wars. The Viceroy of the Trade Federation.
Yep.
All right. And a Viceroy is just like another term for somebody in charge.
Lots of titles.
Lots of titles that kind of all mean the same thing, except if out of Star Wars, because they mean different things then.
Yeah.
So then we get like, oh, almost 18 years pass.
Yeah.
And we get into the Rebels.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. We find out that there's a very complex history, you know, with Sabine throughout the first two seasons. Mm-hmm. And then in the third season, we jump into the Mandalorian history quite heavily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we get like a tiny bit in the Protector of Concordon in season 2. But yeah, it's definitely like season 3 where we really start to get to learn more. And it's especially, we get to learn how much it like comes in like with Sabine's story even more, because like before we like knew she was at the Imperial Academy on Mandalore, and like we knew like she had this past in regards to that. But we really get to like learn about this weapon, the Duchess again, this weapon that she created at the Imperial Academy. And we get to see in seasons 4 specifically how devastating this weapon is for the cultural implications, because of how their armor is such a part of their culture and their society. That
so what like does the weapon do?
The weapon basically, I don't really know the scientific way of saying it. It basically targets Mandalorian armor and it basically disintegrates you. Quite dark.
Targets Mandalorians, yeah. and like kills you dead.
Yeah. And there
that,
you go.
That goes against how they feel like battle and, you know, fights and disagreements should be resolved, right? Yes. Which is who can physically outmaster the other person with their brains and their brawns and everything like that and the tools that they have on them, rather than they, much like magic, they would view this as like cheating, right? Or
And
outside of what they would agree with.
Yeah. And we get to like learn, like when she has a confrontation with Bo-Katan, she's like, you're a Mandalorian, like, where's your honor? Like, why would you do something like this? And then it goes back to kind of their, like, warrior kind of, she was like, I was challenged. It was a challenge and I accepted the challenge. And she's like, yeah, yes, I do regret it now. And I see how bad it is. Like, we get to see how much she is just like, it's such a bad time in her life for her, and just the creation at all, she regrets it so much. But it goes back to like that warrior kind of, I was challenged and I made it. And then I don't know how much I could talk so much. I don't know how, what do you want to keep doing? Do you want me to keep going?
Well, I think, you know, where do we end off with the Mandalorians? We have Bo-Katan, and Sabine has given her the Darksaber to rule again, basically. Like, that's what we end off Rebels knowing happens.
Yeah. So I'll just quickly touch on the other things I like touching on. With the Sabine obviously gets the Darksaber from Maul via the episode with the Night Sisters. Mm-hmm. And ultimately they encourage her to take, because it is a symbol of leadership, they encourage her. This is the only point where I got really kind of annoyed with her. She's like, oh, we can recruit the Mandalorian, Sabine, you should lead them. Like, come on, Hera, like, all right. But as it's seen as like that symbol, they like, Fen Rao's like, oh, Sabine can lead an army of Mandalorians. And so that's obviously how that comes into play. And then ultimately Sabine believes that she's like, I'm not Mandalore's ruler. I don't want to take that responsibility. That's like not my place. So that's why she ends up passing the Darksaber to Bo-Katan. And Bo-Katan and her actually kind of have this like this interesting relationship where they kind of come, because like they're so against each other in terms of this weapon, and they kind of come to like understand each other in a certain kind of way, because especially in the moment when Sabine turns the weapon onto stormtrooper armor, and Bo-Katan is like, this isn't like what we should do. It's kind of, I noted this, like, it's a big turning point for Bo-Katan in a way, because so much of, like I said, so much of Bo-Katan's like past was following that like warrior way of overcoming. Mm-hmm. But in that moment, she kind of values more so the, like the honor of not taking the life like Sabine does with Gar Saxon. So I really like love that moment between them, and how ultimately they're like for Mandalore, and they destroy the weapon together. And then ultimately Bo-Katan does come to claim the Darksaber. And it's Rebel. I just love how much Rebels got to see the growth of Bo-Katan in that way.
Yeah, and both characters too, because Sabine realizes like she's not going to be the ruler of Mandalore, even though Hera, what were you thinking?
I know.
Wanted her to be, you know, out of some sort of convenience to the Rebel Alliance.
Yeah,
a little like, oh, Hera.
Hera,
oh,
why?
Boy. But, you know, she stays on Lothal and helps, you know, Lothal survive and helps her family survive within that. And then we don't know what happens until this, upstart little show called The Mandalorian.
Okay. When the Darksaber popped up, you guys know how much I love Mandalorians. I've been saying it a lot today. Holy crap. I freaked out so much, especially because it's like that big, this is why this, I'm so excited for Mandalorian season 2 and just learning more in general, because like you kind of get like this full circle story with Bo-Katan in a way of, she's finally like the ruler and she has the Darksaber and she's like learned a lot along the way, and then all of a sudden here's getting it with the Darksaber, and we're like, okay, so something happened.
So we learn a couple of things from the start of the show, and it's again shown, not told to us. It's shown through flashbacks, etc. It's shown through the fact that the Mandalorians are like literally living in the sewer system of the city. Like everything is hidden. They don't even know how many there are in the city. Like that to me is just so telling and emblematic of of how far they have fallen. So yes. They are no longer houses. They are a tribe.
Yes.
And using the word tribe, like, kind of denotes how small it is too, right?
Yeah.
And this all happened because of something called the Purge, which Gideon refers to when he took the Darksaber from Mandalore and killed the Mandalorians to dead. Probably destroying the planet, what remained of the planet, because they have no home now.
Yeah.
It feels very much like Zeb and the Lysat.
Yes.
In that, like, you know, this seemed to happen.
Yeah.
Where the Empire would come in and commit a genocide of a people.
Pretty much.
And, like, it's like, you can't do what we want, so we're going to kill you. Yeah. And that happened. Gideon actually was, like, supposed to have been executed for war crimes. I have never heard those words in Star Wars. Ever.
Yeah.
So that was, like, to give us a good idea of how serious everything was. Plus, he has the Darksaber. He cut his own tie open with the Darksaber appeared. He's like, I'm cool and I've got the Darksaber. And everybody freaked out.
Yes.
The Mandalorians themselves going from an interplanetary people to a handful of people potentially spread throughout the galaxy is crazy.
Yeah. I mean,
that's crazy. That's all we know. Like, literally, yeah. That's all we know is that they were in charge of several planetary systems. We know that.
Yes.
Even as of the time of Rebels.
Yes.
They had several planetary systems. Mm-hmm. And now they have none.
It's insane.
So, and that period of time between Rebels and the Mandalorian is about 10 years.
Yes.
So that's how long it takes to... A
lot of time that we could cover now. Yay, let's go.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask a few questions. Right. Why is the helmet not allowed to come off? Because Din is not a born of Mandalorian. They have become like this collection of the creed and the code are all that remains. So maybe there's a few actual Mandalorians left who are just trying to pass on their culture. And it's become more like a knighthood type handoff. We know Katee Sackhoff is going to be in Mandalorian season 2. So we know we will get like Mandalorians back. We know Sabine exists. So they are out there. But like, why can't this helmet come off Din Djarin? Like, I know mythically, I know hero's journey wise, I know all of that reason.
Yeah.
And I know kind of from, you know, from a story perspective and from the fact that they use stunt men to them to film all of his scenes and then he's just over top of that. Like, it's like Dave and John have treated the show like a cartoon.
Yeah.
He is a cartoon character and then they can do the audio over top of it. Which is a very smart way to film the show too, right? Because then you also don't need to put Pablo Pascal into tons of danger. All the time.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You can have the trained professionals be the, you know, the Mandalorian doll. And then he's the voice person. And he's very amazing. Like, he's holding, like, the pillowcase or baby Yoda in his hands while he's, like, doing his voice. But I understand, like, the whole logic about how they do it and why they do it from a technological perspective.
Yeah.
But why can't he take off his helmet?
I believe that it has to do with the, I don't know if it's specifically the creed, but it's definitely a way of Mandalorian honor, I believe. I feel like maybe in a way, it's like their new kind of code in a way, because like their society has gone through such a destruction. And obviously they have to like hide in the sewers now and they're so like hidden. And maybe in a way you could argue, oh, wow, they're hidden. So they keep their helmets on now. But I don't know what I'm saying.
Well, so I definitely agree with you. Like, I think that in an effort to maintain certain strictures of their code, they were like, well, how can we prove you're a Mandalorian? But by saying that you never take the armor off.
Yeah, it's like, right? Yeah, basically because like they can't really follow their warrior ways anymore because of the purge and everything that's happened. This is kind of their way of continuing their kind of culture and society and having a code still, despite the fact their code obviously can't be like tied to warrior principles anymore.
Like it's no different than like a samurai who has to treat their sword a particular way, or you have to wear your tabard or your coat of arms. It's just another method of controlling the uncontrollable.
Yeah.
Right? The fact that they have been exterminated essentially shows that, you know, they need to have certain things in place to give them structure.
Yeah.
Even if it's just the fact that he can't take off his helmet. And my hope is that by finding home, wherever that is, finding his path, finding his journey's end, etc.,
yeah,
like where his community is healed, i.e. the Mandalorians.
Yeah.
And probably also his original family too, like coming to terms with that, I think we'll get to. Speculation for season two, The Mandalorian. Something along those lines would be very apropos of the hero's journey, which I have been saying all along has been going on and has been triply confirmed in the gallery episode.
Yes. So. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
little high self high five.
Yep. There you go. Good job.
But okay, so now into speculation land. What are we going to see?
There's a lot we could see. I mean, like we talked about throughout this conversation, there's like a lot that they could still cover. There's a lot of pockets. There's a lot, not just regarding the time periods, but obviously their culture and stuff. There's still so much they could like build upon. And
So then let me reframe this. What would you most like to see from a story perspective? Because I have my favorites on what I want to see.
How about you go first? I have to think.
Well, I have like three.
All right. You go first.
Okay. So first and foremost, I want to see the Jedi Mandalorian War. I think it would be amazing, especially if we had some sort of dope, amazing romance in there. Because I love that stuff.
Yes.
I love it.
Yes.
I love it so much.
Have people wrote fics? If so, I need to find them. I never thought about that. Honestly.
I think I could totally write a city-state like fic. Like, no, seriously, like all about the structure and stuff.
Yeah.
And then,
yeah.
You know, how it turns into the war.
Yeah.
So that. I want to see it as much as I want to see the Jedi and the Sith split.
Like, yeah.
I think that is going to be a very, very powerful period of time. And I think if we get enough of the history in The Mandalorian season two, they announce a movie series that is set with the Mandalorian Jedi War. People would come droves out like three movies.
Oh, my God.
Mandalorian Jedi War.
Please.
Right?
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. My number two. I would like a book or a comic series or a cartoon about Obi-Wan and Anakin, or Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon and Satine.
Yes. Yes.
I want something.
Yes.
I'm actually going to be okay with it also if it's the Obi-Wan show and it flashes back to the past. I think that would be amazing.
That is a good point. Yes.
Because they could cast Satine and they could age down Ewan.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've seen Liam Neeson.
Oh, yes, yes.
Like, they could just use Liam Neeson because, like, he's not that different. And, like, he would just be in the background or whatever. And it would just, like, showing those scenes specifically on screen, which is just, like, so amazing to see. And then give us, like, the whole thing, like, in a comic book or a book. Written by Claudia Gray. She wants to write it. Just putting that out into the universe.
Yes.
Although she's very busy with the High Republic, I know, but still. All right, so those are my two. What would you like to see? I could probably think of a third, but...
I thought you said you have three.
I have three. In in general, I would like to see a political show about Mandalorian culture with the house structure.
You echo very much my wants.
Okay.
Well, all right, let's see. Well, definitely, I agree with all three that you have said, and I'd want all three, especially the Obi-Wan scene stuff, because, like, please. If we're talking Mandalorians in general, I guess as a personal want, I guess just a background Sabine novel or something, because just please.
Oh, yeah, that'd be cool.
Yeah, and that can really kind of connect to that time period.
What she was doing during the OT time, like during that time, like, because we have nothing,
yeah,
literally nothing. It would be cool to see that, and then you could actually figure out what happens to Mandalore, like, through that.
Yeah, that'd just cool. Anything with Sabine would be amazing. Obviously,
I mean, we're gonna get the show. Like,
I know, but like, I just need it sooner. I need it sooner.
It's coming. I'm sure it's going to be one of the next announcements.
I hope. I keep up my hope every day.
The Where's Ezra show.
Please give it to me.
You know, Ahsoka and Sabine heading out to go and drag Ezra out of Hondo's basement, because that's where I think he's hiding.
Oh my God.
He's in Hondo's basement, just chilling on the couch. He's grown like a terrible quarantine beard.
Oh my God, I'm gonna draw this now.
And he's hanging out with a Purgle, eating like Cheetos.
Oh, I can go. Oh my God, that's perfect. Okay. So yeah, definitely anything Sabine related, whether it either be like the OT time, like that Where's Ezra, or even just to get to like learn more about her time prior to Rebels even, would be cool for me, because like just any Sabine content, honestly, because that could really kind of connect back to because it was the Imperial Academy on Mandalore, so maybe that could even connect more to that time period of when Mandalore is going through this transition period, especially because Ursa Wren also talks a lot about how, like, because Saxon was like with the Empire, it's like we had to like swear loyalty or Clan Ren would be destroyed. It's like that time period where like that shift is occurring, I think would be interesting. But yeah, so Sabine, obviously, that's my one of mine.
Yeah.
Obi-Wan and Satine. And then I definitely just agree with all you said, like either something that touches a lot on like the culture and the clan house kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Like I said, there's so much they could do. I love Mandalorians, so like I'd be cool with honestly anything they do, but those are definitely my top two.
Awesome. All right. I think we've done a good job. What are you interested in seeing from a Mandalorian history? Because there is literally so much to play with. Actually, I would love to see, you know, I just had, you know, in this last little while, Maggie Nowakowska on the podcast, and she talked about early history of Star Wars and how much the universe was theirs to just create and understand and do things in. And we're very much at that point with Mandalorians. Like, if you're interested in writing some cool exploratory fanfic about like houses and the warrior culture, but also like how it could tie into. One thing that we didn't really bring up was that there is this underlayer of creation of art and creativity.
Yes.
That is also part of the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I should probably like frame that. And to me, that's why the Renaissance period of, especially of Italy, is very, very prominent and could be used as a semi-template to talk about the houses. Because that was also the thing. Even though there was constantly fighting in the streets, you know, houses fighting each other, and then, you know, whoever was in charge of the city was like, stab it. Or you're in favor, or you're out of favor, or you can't come to court today. There was also this patron art structure that happened too, where like Leonardo da Vinci was patroned to create art.
Mm-hmm.
You could have both. And that would create such an interesting culture with this threat of the Jedi thinking that maybe your way is wrong.
I also think going off of creation of art, that also kind of goes back to armor in a way. Because even though Sabine's the only one who really goes full out crazy with on armor, their armor still has such a significance, and it's like they forge it to their liking, like Sabine says, but like it still has that historical ties as well as like just the significance within their society, and the way that it's passed down really helps show that history as well.
Yeah, I'm just excited for more. And as somebody who couldn't have cared less about Mandalorians, you know, before, like, except for the fact that Sabine was one and Satine came from them, and I love those characters. The Mandalorian has turned me into a total Mandalorian.
Yay, I'm so glad.
No, and I'm interested to know more, and I want to have it be rich and and delicious to dig into, especially from a political perspective. I loved what we got in Rebels, and I feel like that's just kind of the tip of the iceberg that they were playing with for that period of time. So I hope we get something rich and beautiful. And then I hope it is based on the city state structure, because I'm like, I've read The Prince. I can go.
Yeah.
Home reading, Machiavelli's The Prince. There you go. If you want to catch up. All right. Allie, this is so much fun. Thanks for coming on What the Force.
Oh my God. Thank you so much. I literally was waiting for the time you would ask me. I was so excited to do this. Honestly, I am so grateful. Thank you so much.
And the next time that we have a something cool Mandalorian come out, I'm going to grab you back because you're awesome.
All right. Thank you.
All right, Allie, where can people find you if they're looking for you and everything that you do?
All right. I am on Twitter at Allie_M_Andrews. You can also follow my podcast on Twitter at Knights of Ren, and our podcast can be found on iTunes or podcast.com. And other than that, I do art, I do commissions if people want them. No one's requested one in a long time, but if you want a commission, hey, I do art. But yeah, that's pretty much me.
Thank you again. Cheers. Thank you for listening to What the Force. I'm Marie-Claire Gould, your host. Our music is the What the Force theme, orchestral music by Christy Carew for What the Force. We have a Patreon at patreon.com/whattheforce. We would like to thank all our patrons, especially those who love and are obsessed with What the Force: Brad, Cheryl Bell, Melody, Night Huntress in Wild Space, Susan, Felicia, How Rude, Anna Perez, Macau Mom, Neil, and James. Make sure to like and subscribe on YouTube or leave a 5-star review on iTunes or other podcast apps. It helps others find the show. You can connect with us on Twitter at What the Force Show, What the Force Podcast on Facebook, or our website, whattheforce.ca, or on our new Discord. The links are in the liner notes. Feel free to reach out and start a conversation. Cheers.